The Bone Gardener novella audiobook is written and produced by Sandra A. Sigfusson. Narrated by William Johnston. Silent Waves instrumental music by I. Fisher. No part of this audiobook may be reproduced, shared, or used for artificial intelligence training without the express permission of the author and the narrator. Copyright 2025, all rights reserved. Warning, this novella is a paranormal parable which contains content that may be disturbing to some listeners, including death, fire, depression, and thoughts of suicide. And now, here is The Bone Gardener. Chapter 1. This was not a life Joe had planned as a youth. The things that garnered his attention were far grander than what his future would likely be. He dreamed of being famous, rich, and adored by the public. He wanted to be recognized for talents he wished to hone, such as a revered actor in action movies, or a brilliant musician with throngs of fans dying to see him play in large venues. In his preteen years, while his parents sat motionless, save for sipping hot coffees in their living room chairs watching the news, Joe would play-act parts of his favorite movies or sing and play air guitar in his bedroom behind a closed door. Deep down, he knew his shyness would be his biggest hurdle, but that didn't stop him from performing for the action figures dutifully displayed on his bookshelf next to the closet. Joe kept most of his desires secret from his parents, as he knew they'd scoff at his dreams. They were practical people, not the sorts to want for things they could not have. "Dreams come to you in the night, Joe, not during the day. If you have dreams of being anything more than what you are today, I wish you luck," his mother would say. "But for now, get back to your chores. I've not got all day to watch you dilly-dally." Joe shrugged and went about his business of cutting the grass, weeding the garden, and watering the flowers his mother had planted in front of the old creamery shop at the foot of their property. 3 generations had managed the old shop, and it seemed that the only thing in Joe's future was to follow in his father's footsteps. "Everyone else gets to ride their bikes, play in the woods, or swim in the lake on weekends," he muttered to himself. "This sucks!" Nobody heard his complaints over the whirring blades and the loud hum of the motor on the lawnmower. When Joe finished, he sat down on the wood stairs and wiped his forehead with the bottom edge of his t-shirt. The screen door squeaked open behind him, and his mother brought him a tall glass of fresh lemonade. "Thanks, Mom," he said, then let out a heavy sigh. "Joe, if you've finished your chores, you can join your friends in the lake. I'll help your father in the creamery this afternoon." "Yes, thank you," he replied. He downed as much of the lemonade in one gulp as he could, then ran to the lake's edge while peeling off his sweat-laden t-shirt. He was waist-deep in the lake before his mother could tell him to be careful. Since the creamery's erection by the sturdy hands of Joe's great-grandfather, not much had changed in over 130 years. Joe's father, Arthur, made artisan cheeses and supplied fresh milk to the neighbors out of the aging structure. If not for the hanging flower baskets and small garden on the left side, one would drive past the building assuming it was someone's old garage. It lacked any refinement, including insulation. Upstairs, a loft area stored random things out of sight and mind. A good place for Joe to hide when he needed space from his parents. A few Spider-Man comic books, a flashlight, and a sleeping bag were neatly stashed in the back corner. When she was in the mood, Joe's mom would make her famous June's Walnut Brownies, and those too sold at the creamery for 25 cents per square. In the summer months, Arthur would make 3 flavors of ice cream for the tourists. That was Joe's favorite time of year. "Why don't we make snow cones for summer too?" Joe asked his dad on a particularly muggy day. "We could make cherry, strawberry, or orange even." "Son, we need the ice to keep the milk and cheese cold," his dad said. "Until I can afford to buy new freezers, we can't waste our ice blocks on snow cones." Arthur was a nose-to-the-grindstone kind of man. He toiled with purpose, taking few breaks. Time was something he never wanted to waste. But he was also fair. He paid Joe in the summer for working at the creamery. Joe earned $5 per day on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, the busy days, when Arthur needed Joe's help the most. As much as Joe enjoyed earning $15 per week working for his dad, he missed having fun with his friends. He'd often stand in front of the creamery, watching the kids from his neighborhood horse around in the lake across the street. They would float on inner tubes, spraying one another with squirt guns. But it wasn't the fun they were having that Joe envied. It was their laughter. They didn't have a care in the world. Joe missed that freedom. As the years passed, Joe felt his youthful dreams fading. He was born to June and Arthur when they were in their mid-40s. Joe's arrival was a miracle, as June was certain she'd never become pregnant after so many years of trying. Alas, they were blessed with a healthy baby boy on March 31, 1964, Joseph Arthur White. June and Arthur retired when Joe was 20. June had been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and shortly after, Arthur was told he had stage 3 liver cancer. Now at the age of 28, the family too poor to hire anyone to manage their medical needs, Joe was burdened with the care of his parents while managing his father's creamery shop. Joe had taken over producing the artisan cheeses that Arthur used to make several years prior. Against his father's wishes, he even added snow cones to the menu board for the summer, which was the huge hit with the kids that Joe always knew it would be. Joe turned 40 by the time Arthur and June had passed. Arthur fought cancer for 5 years before he lost his battle. June's diabetes was stable for several years, but she was forced to remain in a wheelchair until her dying day. On good days, Joe would wheel June down to the creamery so she could manage the sales counter. She enjoyed talking to people and seeing the neighborhood kids playing in the lake across the street. It was the only thing that kept her feeling like she still had a place in the community. After June had died, Joe felt lost for a purpose, uninspired to make for himself the life of which he once yearned. His dreams seemed distant now, as did marriage. Of the available women in his small town, he could count on one hand how many were palpable. His choosiness kept him from finding a good wife. For several months, Joe went about his business in predominant silence. He spoke only to his customers and found some solace in the library of books his father amassed. Playing guitar was also a satisfactory way to pass time. The influx of summer travelers bloated the sales for 2 full months, which kept the creamery afloat. Thus, Joe had to be sure to use his profits from the summer season wisely. It paid the bills, but left little to add to his savings account. As Joe lay sleeping in bed one early fall night, with an open book splayed across his chest and his glasses perched cockeyed upon the bridge of his nose, he awoke to the scent of burning wood filing in from his open bedroom window. Upon opening his eyes, desperate to focus them in the dark space, Joe tossed the half-read book aside along with his quilt and leapt to his feet. His pulse raced as he straightened his glasses to gaze out the window. Gripped in shock, he watched in horror as his only means of income burned to the ground. "Oh my God, the creamery!" he yelled as he scrambled down the stairs, dashing through his front door. The last of the strong roof timbers of the 158-year-old simple-framed structure crashed to the ground with thunderous abandon, throwing a mass of sparks and flames high into the darkness of night. Joe raised his arms to cover his face to shield himself from the heat and the shocking brightness of the flames. He was too late to save the only thing left with meaning and purpose in his lonely life. His business was lost, and any hope that came with it. By the time the firefighters arrived on scene, there was nothing left but hot embers, black charred truss timbers, and ash. His neighbors came rushing from their homes to assist, but the tender, dry old creamery structure was gone in mere minutes. "Are you all right, Joe?" Catherine asked as she approached his side while cinching her bathrobe ties. Joe reluctantly nodded. Physically, he was fine. Emotionally, he was a mess. "It was all I had left, Kath. I don't have insurance or savings to rebuild," he said. Catherine wrapped an arm around Joe's waist to comfort him, as his mother often did. Just then he thought of his mom, and another layer of sadness gripped his chest with unfathomable heartache. The next morning, As Joe surveyed the damage and debris left behind from the fire, he began to believe that his town, named Garden of Eden, was cursed. Nothing good ever happened here. What wishful thinking clouded the mind of the founder of this godforsaken place? He muttered aloud to himself. Joe kicked at a few of the charred beams, which left a black streak across the top of his right sneaker. Just then, a few local kids on their bikes stopped by the edge of the property to view the destruction. Wide-eyed, Kyle asked, "Whoa, Joe, what happened?" Joe smirked, wanting to point out the obvious, but he bit his tongue. "I'm not sure, Kyle. Maybe someone drove by last night and tossed a cigarette out the window. Your guess is as good as mine." "Does this mean you won't be selling ice cream or snow cones anymore?" "Sorry, Kyle. No more ice cream or snow cones this year." Joe kicked at the charred wood beam again, watching the blackened chunks crumble beside his shoes, even though it was still quite wet from the dousing from the fire truck. Seconds later, a bit of steam rose from under a beam, like a latent arsonist ghost was escaping the scene of the crime. Half of his lawn, which he'd so dutifully cared for even after his parents' passing, was burned as well. The only saving grace was that his home was still standing. He peered back over his shoulder to look at the home as Kyle and his friends rode off chatting with each other. It needed a lot of work. He'd have to build a new front porch, new stairs, give the wood siding a fresh coat of paint, and replace the window in the upstairs bedroom which had cracked in the heat of the fire. This was almost too much for Joe to bear. It would be years before he could afford to do any of those repairs without a way to earn a living. With no future and no wife or children to adore, Joe suffered a mental breakdown. Even with the locals coming to his rescue with food and concern for his well-being after the tragic fire, it was not enough to stay his deep-seated depressive state. He reflected for days. Out of pure desperation, Joe began regularly attending church in the hopes that, by aligning with God, something positive would grace him. Perhaps the locals would take pity on his situation and offer him odd jobs for cash. He also trusted the social aspect of the church could keep him emotionally stable until he found a regular job. "There is comfort in numbers," June often said when she talked about her beloved church. That phrase echoed in Joe's head. Joe confessed his position to the minister, his fears for the future, his gripping sadness, and a life filled with loss and disappointment. "I am penniless," Joe confided in Father MacDonald. "If I'm savvy with what little money I have left, I might make it through to Christmas without work. Father, is there anything I can do for your church that could earn me the money I need to keep the lights and heat on in my home?" Father MacDonald offered Joe a pensive smile as he tried to decide how to help poor Joe in this time of need. Many in his congregation had already given Joe as much as they could spare, but in truth, their generosity was not enough. "I'm sorry, Joe. I know you've been through many struggles in your life, but have faith. God will provide for you when the time is right," he said, patting Joe gently on the shoulder as they sat together in the third row pew of the intimate community church. Joe nodded and mustered a smile. "Thank you, Father. I'll pray that something worthy of my skills will come swiftly."
"I'll pray for you too, Joe."
Father MacDonald eased himself from the pew and walked with Joe to the doorway.
"Were you able to save some of those wonderful cheeses you make, Joe?"
"Yes, thankfully. I keep them in the cellar of the house. I'll bring some to share at the afternoon tea on Sunday, Father."
"That's very kind, Joe. I have an excess amount of rye bread that Mrs. Jacobson gave me yesterday. Shall we make a trade?"
"I'd like that," Joe said as he shook the father's hand. "See you Sunday." 3 days later, Joe was nervous after his first Sunday back at church. When his parents became too ill to attend, Joe stopped going to church as well. It had been several years since then, and unbeknownst to his parents, Joe never truly believed in a higher power. But this was crisis time, and if he had to have faith in God to find his new path, it was worth a try. He held his cup of tea in his hand while he smiled and nodded at the other parishioners gathered in the basement for refreshments, cheese courtesy of Joe, baked goods, and egg salad sandwiches after Father MacDonald's Sunday service. Mrs. Atchison approached Joe, and he froze in place. Every town has their gossip queen, and Mrs. Atchison was Garden of Eden's. She switched her purse from her right arm to her left before reaching out to touch Joe's arm.
Joe, how wonderful to see you in church again. How have you been since your parents passed on?
She stroked her palm down his sleeve, then gave Joe's hand a gentle squeeze. She held her face mere inches from his, which made Joe nervous. He didn't like close talkers. It was like they were attempting to lord something over the person they were verbally accosting. He smiled politely and took one step backward to create a bit of breathing space. Oh, I'm doing okay, I suppose. I do miss their company. The house just isn't the same without them there. Mrs. Atchison nodded, then spoke again, only this time using a quieter voice.
I hear through the grapevine...
Joe interrupted. You mean the telephone, Mrs. Atchison? She smiled and hid a giggle behind her hand over her mouth.
Yes, quite. I heard that you were in need of some kind of work since you lost our beloved creamery. I'll speak to those I can, and maybe something will come up for you.
Thank you, Mrs. Atchison. I'd appreciate it. Joe pondered her use of the words, our creamery, and that's when he realized how many years and how many locals had shopped there. As the congregation dissipated, Joe left the church to walk home. He pondered as many options for work as he could, such as mowing neighbors' lawns, washing cars, delivering newspapers, or painting houses. His only other option was to leave Garden of Eden in search of gainful employment, but he'd have to sell his childhood home and risk the only thing he had of value to his name. That could take months or years to sell his humble abode. Thus, this was not the best option. In the meantime, he'd wait to hear if Mrs. Atchison had done as she said she would. Help him find work through her grapevine. A few weeks later, when Joe's cupboards were bare and taxes were overdue on his home, he nearly succumbed to a situational depression. He discovered a bottle of prescription opioid pain pills left in the medicine cabinet that were his father's, refilled days before his passing. He held the pill container in his hand, staring at it for the longest time. Would anybody miss me if I was suddenly gone? He asked himself. His incredulous chuckle filled the bathroom and seemed to echo back to him from down the empty hall. The silence that followed didn't have the answer Joe was so desperate to attain either. What was the answer to his problems? Money? He glanced at his sullen reflection, a shell of the man he should be. What sage advice would his father have given him at this moment? Come on, Dad! Where are your words of wisdom when I need them the most? Not expecting an answer, Joe threw the pill bottle against the wall with a force fueled by his sudden, indescribable anger. He watched as the tablets scattered across the black and white checkerboard bathroom floor tiles, fanning the breadth of the room. Joe's anger suffocated his sadness, choking his true feelings out from where they lay dormant. Why did God deal him such a terrible hand in life? What could Joe have done to deserve the short end of the stick, day after day, for the bulk of his entire existence? Joe let his anger slowly subside as he collected the wayward tablets from every nook and cranny of the floor space. The motion of crawling upon the floor made him feel like a beggar, a lowlife in a dirty alley, scrambling for wayward coins lost from the hand of a wandering stranger, or digging inside waste bins for half-eaten sandwiches. Shaking his head to clear those negative thoughts, he stood before the toilet, then tossed the pain pills into the bowl to flush them away, watching them swirl down into oblivion in a counterclockwise direction. Then Joe waited to listen for the last gurgle of the toilet to be sure the pills were no longer within his reach. He wasn't going to let whomever it was in the sky torture him any more. He stared hard at his own reflection in the bathroom mirror again and growled like a bear and made a mean face at himself. No more, he shouted. Chapter 2. With Joe's newfound inner strength, he did what he could to earn whatever income was possible. He knocked on every resident's door and asked if they needed help. He was prepared to dig ditches, build chicken coops, trim trees, weed gardens, walk dogs, or feed pets when the resident was on vacation, whatever the homeowner needed. This earned him a small but steady income, nonetheless. It was enough money to get him through the winter after paying the property taxes that were long overdue. His diligence was paying off. Come January 1st, the town found its customary celebrations buried 6 feet deep in a heavy blanket of snow. Local folks called each other to wish them a Happy New Year in lieu of parties or simple gatherings. It was also impossible to work, so Joe stayed holed up in his house, reading books and doing minor repairs to keep his mind and body busy. Nobody was able to drive on the roads for several days until the snowplow from the nearest town came to clear a path to the essential places, such as the grocery store, police station, Dr. Elgin's house, and the fire hall. Even the church was left on the lurch without a clearing path to its holy doors temporarily. During the frozen wintry standstill, Father MacDonald called each of his parishioners, including Joe.
"Joe, I'm hoping my call finds you well. How are you holding up?"
"Not so bad, Father. I thought my house was quiet with me being all alone. But this heavy dump of snow brings that quiet to a new level. I can finally hear myself think," he joked. "And that's not necessarily a good thing."
"Well, we can pray for it to ease up soon. And prayer always does the mind and heart good. Have you spoken with anyone else these past few days?"
"No, I don't like to talk on the phone, Father. I've been a little short for words these past few months. I just keep my head down and do the work I need to keep the lights on, you know."
"Fair enough. If you need me, my phone is always nearby. Call me any time, Joe."
"Will do, Father." As Joe hung up the phone, he realized that Father MacDonald was right. Prayer was always there when you needed to quiet a confused mind. It was peaceful, meditative, and offered a glimmer of hope in times of trial. 2 days later, on a clear, bitterly cold day, the news of the cemetery caretaker's untimely death spread throughout the town, one phone call at a time by Father MacDonald. Jeremy, who lived in a small cottage with his wife at the edge of Eden Lake, had been clearing his driveway after the plow had been through the town's main roads. While shoveling, he suffered a swift, fatal heart attack. Discovering Jeremy slumped over on a snowbank beside their driveway, deceased and nearly frozen solid, his wife, Jen, wailed to anyone who could hear her cries. This shocking tragedy filled the small community of Garden of Eden with overwhelming sorrow. Jeremy had a heart of gold and would do anything for anyone, without question. As sad as it was to lose a local, one who was much loved by the community, Joe knew there would be a job opening at the cemetery as a caretaker. He promptly called Mr. Blake, the funeral director at the Eden Funeral Home, to remind him that he was available to work should there be not any other candidates willing to take over for Jeremy. As uncouth as it seemed to be so swift to inquire about being Jeremy's replacement, Joe knew it was the early bird that catches the worm. If he hadn't put his name in the hat now, he'd miss a perfectly good opportunity to have a full-time job in this sleepy little town. Could it be this was how the good Lord was providing for Joe? Still, this felt like a terrible way to receive good fortune, and unsure if this was God's doing. To Joe's delight, Mr. Blake returned his phone inquiry the following afternoon.
"Joe, I am amenable to hiring you," he said in his deep professional salesperson voice.
It was simply a formality to interview Joe briefly over the phone, as Mr. Blake knew nobody else would consider the position. During the telephone conversation, Mr. Blake said,
"Joe, I think you'd make a fine caretaker. Officially, you'll be working for the county, as they own the cemetery lands and the funeral home building. They've entrusted me to find Jeremy's replacement. However, until the winter snow becomes less cumbersome to the community, they will not need your services. Can you start in your new position on February 1st?
"Yes, of course, Mr. Blake. I still have a few small jobs around my home I can manage in the meantime. I will see you at 9 a.m. on the 1st of February, sir. Thank you for the opportunity." For the first time in Joe's life, he said a prayer of thanks to God. Initially, he'd only attend church as a last-ditch effort and to be able to talk to others in hopes of finding work. It would seem his decision was fruitful, finally. Joe now believed God did exist, and all he had to do was to have faith for his pitiful life to change in positive directions. Rather than bite the hand that feeds him, Joe decided he'd continue his weekly Sunday church attendance without further question. During the winter months, Joe noticed that his mother's beloved window plants were suffering. The low winter light and his forgetfulness to water them regularly was showing in their sad state. He'd heard his mother once discussing talking to plants with Mrs. Maddock, her favorite gossip sister. They were not blood-related, but they were sisters in spirit. The two women decided to experiment with talking to their plants to see if it truly made a difference, and after a few months the ladies had concluded that indeed it was of benefit. Mrs. Maddock insisted that her cherry tomato seedlings were twice the size of last year's crop, and June agreed her spinach and garlic window plantings were far more robust than last season's. For Joe, this was enough evidence to practice talking to his mother's plants and placing a reminder note on the refrigerator to not forget to water them each Tuesday morning. Over the next few weeks, the plants responded favorably to Joe's soft conversation, gentle pruning, and consistent watering. It's not as though Joe had anyone else to talk to. Thus, the plants in the window made for quiet companions. Chapter 3. Joe's excitement on January 31st could not be hidden. Tomorrow will be his first day at his new full-time job. He was sure there wouldn't be anything too difficult to do. He was already quite handy, and surely one of the primary reasons for Mr. Blake to hire him. On his first day of work, Mr. Blake gave Joe a full tour of his operations. As Mr. Blake had stated in his interview conversation, he owned the business, but the land and the buildings belonged to the county. Recently, the county had approved Mr. Blake's request for a subsidy to upgrade the building, which included electrical, plumbing, exterior repairs, and a new set of wood steps at the entrance. Together, he and Joe planned for when each of the upgrades were to be done. Since it was still winter, it was best to start on the inside of the building and work their way outside as the weather permitted. One of the things that Joe noted when he buried his parents in the cemetery was how dowdy the landscape of the property was. It could use some seasonal flowers to make the graveyard more appealing for visitors. He approached Mr. Blake about his thoughts. "Sir, do you think we could add a bit of color and some shrubs to the property to make it more appealing for visitors?" Mr. Blake thrummed his fingers over his leather desk mat while he pondered Joe's question.
"You might be right, Joe. The cemetery has been strictly lawn and a few cedar trees smattered over the grounds for as long as I've been here. Color would be nice. I'm sure the county council will approve of your adding a personal touch. They don't much care what I do as long as the grass is cut."
"I'll look into starting plants from seeds to keep the costs down," Joe said, as a wide smile graced his otherwise serious face. Although Jeremy had been a competent caretaker, he did not have visions or desire to improve on what already existed. Mr. Blake found Joe's suggestions refreshing. As winter turned to spring and the weather allowed, Joe took his first run over the lawn with the old motorized riding lawnmower. It took a few turns of the key to get the old girl to spark up, so he made a mental note to do an oil change and a quick tune-up before he used her again. He was careful not to drive over any of the flat-laid tombstones. He used a weed-eater or hand clippers to clean up the grasses around each grave. Painstaking, but satisfying work. Next, he rented a power washer to remove the excess moss and dirt from 100 years of neglect that had stained the older headstones. For the more fragile markers, he used a scrub brush to hand-clean them for fear of premature deterioration of their structure. It would seem the cemetery grounds were simple to maintain. The more complex jobs were maintenance on the funeral home building. The one task that Joe was not as skilled in was electrical work. He had surmised that his upgrade to his creamery building just a week before it burned to the ground was due to his improvised electrical work to add a sensor light fixture above the back door. He'd been prudent to discuss this with Mr. Blake. While Joe warmed his chilled hands inside the funeral home, he brought his concern to Mr. Blake's attention. "Sir, I'd advise that you hire a professional for the electrical panel upgrade. I'm afraid my skill sets do not include proficiency in electrical work."
"Understandable, Joe."
Mr. Blake winced at the thought of paying for an electrician. The cost would dip substantially into the subsidy the county provided, but it was best to be safe than sorry.
"Is there anything else you're not comfortable doing?"
"No, sir. Just electrical." The next step was to grow some flowers from seed to plant around the building and the pathways to the cemetery. Using leftover lumber and a roll of plastic sheeting from his own supplies, and with permission from Mr. Blake, Joe built a small greenhouse at the back of the main office building next to the parking lot. Here he could toil in the off hours with seeds in hopes of planting the blooms and shrubs when the last frost had passed. Everything was coming together nicely, and Joe had never felt more accomplished than he did working as the caretaker. God had indeed provided for Joe in his time of need, he thought. Chapter 4. On one early summer afternoon, Joe took a stroll through the graveyard and noted how well his recently planted seedling shrubs had been growing. He had incorporated his mother's experiment of talking to the plantings as they grew, and felt it made a marked difference. Joe also found himself talking to the lost souls he tended in the cemetery. It began innocently enough. Joe often talked to himself while he worked. Thus, talking to the dead didn't seem out of the ordinary. He decided that if he could believe in God, then he could also believe in the spirits of the deceased. Every day after lunch, Joe wandered the grounds and said hello to each of the residents. He referred to them as residents in Mr. Blake's presence, which garnered a chuckle from him.
"I guess you could call them that, Joe. Too bad I can't collect monthly rent from them. Then we'd really be rolling in it."
His eyes nearly disappeared when he smiled or laughed as his rosacea-covered chubby cheeks lifted high in those moments. But laughter from Mr. Blake was on rare occasions.
"Sure, sure," Joe replied and nodded.
He had no idea how much money an undertaker made, but based on Mr. Blake's crisp suits and expensive taste in ties, he assumed it was a generous profit. On Monday mornings, whenever possible, Joe visited his parents' graves. He would sit on the grass between them and discuss the recent Sunday sermon that Father MacDonald had presented to the congregation. Joe knew his parents would be happy to hear he'd returned to attending church, and the subject of the sermons was something he could easily share with them. By midsummer, Joe noticed several of the plots where his residence lay had a strange-looking plant rising from beneath the grass. He had only planted pansies, daisies, tulips, daffodils, and impatiens at the foot of the graves. Thus, this unusual plant baffled him. Could it have been something in the potting soil he used to grow the flowers that contained another type of plant, Joe wondered. He stood before one of the growths and scratched his head for a moment. Kneeling to touch the growth, he noted that the stems were incredibly firm, like hardwood, but they had no bark covering and felt as smooth as silk. A head-scratcher it surely was. He wondered if he should consult Mr. Blake about these strange plants, but thought it best to wait until the fall to see if they died off in the change of seasons, or were hardy enough to withstand winter like an evergreen tree. As Joe continued to tend to his residence and the surrounding grounds, he decided that next year he'd plant only primary-colored annual blooms where the younger people were buried, to remind visitors of their youth. People often forgot that there are many children buried here. He was always thinking of ways to spruce things up and keep the graves looking well tended. Mr. Blake would often peer out his office window to watch Joe at work. He was proud of the diligence and the sincerity that Joe bestowed upon this out-of-the-way graveyard in a sleepy little town. The townsfolk spoke highly of Joe's changes and thanked him each Sunday for being so doting and respectful of their dearly departed. In the first weekend of August, a man and his wife visiting the area came upon the graveyard and were stunned by the beauty of Joe's plantings and perfect lawns. Being a reporter for the Jacob County Times, the visitor and his wife thought the attention to detail made an otherwise somber place of rest look more like a botanical garden. Some folks came from miles around to see what Joe had done as word of mouth spread from one town to the next. The following week, Joe and Mr. Blake received a copy of the newspaper article about how lovely the Garden of Eden Cemetery was. All graveyards should take note of the most beautiful resting place in Jacobs County. He also wrote, "Why must a graveyard be dowdy and dreary? Caretaker Joe White has single-handedly created a place of visual joy for those who visit the dearly departed." As the week passed, Joe became a local hero. The newspaper article was the talk of the town. Locals would even spend time on weekends picnicking in the gardens while the weather was still warm, or spending a quiet stroll through the graveyard to enjoy the flowers that seemed to bloom endlessly at the foot of each grave under Joe's care. Joe was rightfully proud of himself for his accomplishments, but he didn't let the sudden fame go to his head. It only made him more determined to keep up his good work for the public and for the good Lord that graced him with this important job opportunity. Soon the visitors also began to notice the strange bark-free trees that were sprouting at each of the graves. They were nearing a foot tall by midsummer, but nobody could decide what kind of plant it was. Joe remained equally baffled, since he'd never seen anything like it, nor had he physically planted them like the other flowers and shrubs in the cemetery. Now there was another reason for word to spread like wildfire to the other towns in the county about this strange plant. Joe's notoriety grew bigger each passing day, and the strange plants grew stronger and taller as Joe continued to say his hellos to his residents each afternoon and talk to the plants as he watered them by hand. As interest and notoriety continued, scientists from the nearby university came to the cemetery to view the unknown plants in hopes of confirming the species, or better yet, discovering something new that had never been seen before. The cemetery became a circus of visitors to Mr. Blake's chagrin. As much as he enjoyed the popularity for possible profitable reasons, he was dismayed by the constant influx of visitors disturbing his working hours to the point of distraction.
"Joe, you know I'm proud of the work you've done, but is there any way we can limit the amount of disruption from curious sorts? I can't work under these conditions. It's far too hectic," he stated as he waved his arms in the air for added effect.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Blake. I had no idea so many people would find our little cemetery so interesting. Would you rather I not plant so many flowers next spring?"
Mr. Blake huffed and shook his head.
"No, Joe. To be honest, I'm getting more business interest from this brouhaha than I can manage. If it were not for the increase in sales, I'd be much more frustrated."
"Perhaps, if there are so many people interested in visiting the Garden of Eden Cemetery, we should charge a small admission fee, or charge for parking in order to defray the extra costs in garbage collection and damage to the beautiful lawns that I have painstakingly nurtured to a lush, deep green," Joe offered.
"We need some order here, Joe. That's all I'm saying."
"Yes, sir. It is becoming difficult for me to maintain on my own. We may need to hire an extra caretaker to help me part-time in these summer months."
Mr. Blake adjusted his new necktie and cleared his throat.
"Are you sure you didn't plant those weird white trees at each grave, Joe? I know you have a green thumb, but they have everyone baffled. And in all honesty, I think those trees are quite grotesque."
"Would you like me to remove them, sir?"
Mr. Blake stuffed his stubby hands inside his suit pant pockets and thought for a moment.
"Let's charge for parking, as you suggested. We may as well make a profit for the county from the oddity and the disruption. I came into this business because I like peace and quiet. The dead are quiet. This," he said, gesticulating with a broad wave of his hand in front of his window with a view of the cemetery, "this is not peace and quiet, Joe. When winter approaches and all the fuss has died down, I recommend you remove all the weird trees."
"Of course, sir. I'll do my best."
Mr. Blake's orders saddened Joe. Even though he hadn't planted the unnamed trees, it seemed a shame to rid the grounds of anything that wasn't a weed. Were these trees weeds? He supposed, to Mr. Blake, they were.
Chapter 5. The scientist from the university returned with a request to take a sample, if not an entire plant, from the cemetery for a full examination. Mr. Blake gave them permission to extract as many as they wanted for research purposes, much to Joe's disappointment. When they began to dig toward the root of one of the trees, they found the root system was exceedingly deep.
As Joe watched them attempt to remove one, he felt a pain in his chest as though they were removing one of his children. Joe shook his head at that silly notion. They are plants, he reminded himself. Giving up on removing the plant they had been so diligently digging at, the scientist decided that a sample from the plant was sufficient. Joe provided them with his best tree pruners to clip off a limb. This too proved to be quite difficult, but after much struggle, a piece snapped off finally. This difficulty of procuring a sample garnered a lengthy discussion between the scientists while they stood in the parking lot examining it before returning to their lab. When the scientists left, Joe went back to the tree they removed the sample from and had a chat with it. He apologized to the resident for the unscrupulous pruning and reset the dirt that had been removed from around its root system. He then replaced the missing grass patch with fresh grass seed. Late that evening, Mr. Blake was informed by his security company that the alarm at the funeral home was sounding off. He arrived swiftly to inspect the premises, only to discover that no one had broken into his place of business. He decided it must have been a squirrel climbing up the side of the building that tripped the alarm, since nothing else was out of the ordinary. Checking each window and locking the front door behind him, he opted to take a little walk among the residents. If there was someone trying to break into the funeral home, he may spot them lurking among the graves and could call the police to deal with the intruder. A waning gibbous moon in a cloudless sky hung over the graveyard. It illuminated the pathway between the graves without the aid of a flashlight. Assured now that all was safe, Mr. Blake bent down to inspect the strange trees sprouting from the foot of each grave. Without the desire to touch them, he muttered, "You don't scare me," as if it were an affirmation to comfort himself. Mr. Blake then turned heels to return to his car. As he walked the pathway, he felt the earth beneath his feet move. Shocked momentarily, he then chuckled to himself, believing his mind was playing tricks on him. The following morning, when Joe returned to work, he was shocked to discover the strange trees had tripled in size overnight. He rubbed his eyes with his fists to be sure he wasn't dreaming, then looked again at the trees. "This is a miracle," he said as he slowly walked between the graves, in a state of pure awe. He stopped at the tree which had been clipped by the scientists and discovered the branch had regrown overnight as well. Joe stroked a finger over the branch with care, then smiled, knowing the tree had fully recovered from the injury. Over the next few days, the trees grew larger and larger, arching over to connect with the next row of trees like a lattice tunnel. The branches wove into each other as if they were clasping hands. No one had seen anything like it. What baffled Joe most was that these trees had no foliage, no leaves, no flowers, just long, hard prongs of branches, almost snow-white in color, and as smooth to the touch as a baby's bottom. Once the word got out, the fascination for the trees reached far and wide yet again. Botanists from every corner of the planet fled to the tiny little hamlet of Garden of Eden to see the work of Joe White. Television crews began to arrive in droves, all wanting to talk to Joe and Mr. Blake about the unusual trees and the stunning gardens. Mr. Blake insisted that if the cemetery and his business were to be so terribly interrupted, that payment for the interviews was required. Otherwise, the reporters could not speak with him or Joe. His stern words echoed through the coffin display room as he addressed Joe. "No client needing the services of a funeral home would be willing to wade through that crowd to enter my place of business." "Agreed, Mr. Blake. But surely, once the notoriety wears off, the desire for many to make Garden of Eden their final resting place will make up for this short-term disruption. You've already had a boost in business, thankfully."
"I'm going to hold you to those words, Joe."
Mr. Blake exited the display room in a huff, leaving Joe to wonder how much longer this circus of people, camera crews, and teenagers taking selfies with the trees would end, too. After a week of non-stop visitors and interviews, and just when Joe and Mr. Blake thought things would go back to normal, one of the locals, Helena Peterson, pointed out that she could see the face of Mary Magdalene within the connected branches of the trees. All hell broke loose. If Mr. Blake thought his cemetery was a circus before then, he was in for a big surprise. In the following weeks, cars lined the street for miles. Mr. Blake was once again raking in money for the county coffers hand over fist for parking fees, entry to the cemetery grounds fees, and he gleefully pocketing the interview fees. He decided that if his life is to be so unceremoniously disrupted, he was to earn every possible dollar he could as compensation. Joe, on the other hand, gave his interview fees to the church as donations. Joe was swept away from his duties as the caretaker under the guiding hand of the church to conduct television interviews in far-flung places like New York, Los Angeles, Dallas, and Miami. He had never been anywhere but to his aunt's house in Toronto when he was 10, so he felt a bit apprehensive about traveling. He was provided with an agent by Father MacDonald to manage his interview schedule and spend the better part of September traveling on behalf of the church. On the streets outside the television studios, Joe's growing fan base would try to touch him, kiss his hands, and some would kneel before him as he exited the building to be escorted by limousine to his next interview. He couldn't understand the interest in him since he'd not planted the trees, but everyone knew it was his golden touch, gifted to him by God, that made them flourish. Finally, Joe's childhood dream of becoming famous had come to fruition, albeit in a completely different manner than he ever imagined it would. In the evenings, while he rested in lavish accommodations in glorious hotels, he pined to be back at the cemetery. He missed saying hello to his residents, watering the plants, mowing the grass, and tending to the trees. Everything was so different and new and scary to Joe now. He hoped that soon this fascination with him and his trees would come to an end, and his simple life would be returned to him. Mr. Blake called Joe to let him know that everything was under control. He need not rush back home, as he had hired a second caretaker to maintain the property and the cemetery in his stead. Joe frowned. This made him angry, in fact. Nobody could replace him. The residents would not allow it. They depended on Joe, and Joe loved that his garden flourished under his care. On the last scheduled interview, Joe felt relieved that he could return home and everything could go back to the way it was. In the meantime, publishing houses were inquiring if they could convince him to author a book about the cemetery, but Joe knew he could do no such thing. He'd need a ghostwriter to pen his story. The highest offer Joe received for his story to be ghostwritten and published was a cool $1 million, including movie rights, in case someone wanted to film his life story. That was enough money to live on for a lifetime, Joe thought. How could he turn down such a generous offer? He couldn't. Joe agreed to sign a publishing contract before taking his flight home to Garden of Eden. The title of his book would be The Bone Gardener, The Joe White Story. When Joe asked his publisher why they were calling him The Bone Gardener, they replied, "Didn't you hear, Joe? Scientists have concluded the trees have the same DNA structure as bones. Hence, you are the Bone Gardener." Chapter 6. Upon Joe's return to the Garden of Eden, he discovered hordes of people had been camping out on his front lawn. In fact, they had taken it upon themselves to clean up the debris left behind from his burned-down creamery. In its place was a large food truck offering hot dogs, hamburgers, and French fries to the campers. The throngs of campers greeted Joe with open arms, rushing to him as he exited the car, just as others had done when he arrived at the airport. They all wore T-shirts with a picture of his likeness and the words, "Praise the Bone Gardener," printed on them. This was getting out of hand. Nothing was sacred anymore. Joe tried to hide his frustration, but it was too much to bear. He called the police to have the campers removed, but there was nothing the police could do to prevent his fans from setting up camp on the street in front of his home or the parking area at the lake. He would have to suffer the privacy issue until such time as his fame dissipated. Joe returned to the cemetery the next day to continue his work as the caretaker. He was shocked to see his gardens, the lawn, and the trees had suffered in his absence. Clearly, the substitute caretaker was of no use. Crushed by the damage from thousands of visitors, Joe set to work immediately to remedy the situation before the cool fall weather and winter set in. Mr. Blake seemed oblivious to the damage the property had sustained, as he was far more interested in the money rolling in than how well the interim caretaker had maintained Joe's landscaping. It would take weeks of hard work to bring the property back to its former glory. While Joe ate his lunch, Mr. Blake approached him and shook his hand.
Glad to see you back, Joe. It has been a whirlwind of non-stop tourists, photographers, reporters, and fans of yours since you left on tour for the church. In fact, I have a massive wait list of people dying to be buried here.
Is that a pun, sir? Joe asked. Mr. Blake chuckled.
Yes, Joe, it is indeed. But don't fret. I have decided that since it was you who brought so much fame and fortune to my humble business, I'm willing to share my substantial profits with you. It's only fair.
I see. And how much money have we earned?
Well, I'll have to tally the numbers, but I'm not an unreasonable business person. I must give 10% to the county for charging an entry fee and parking, but I think you should be cut in for 15% of the net profits, Mr. Blake stated,
looking quite proud of himself for being so generous. 15%? I'll have to discuss that with my agent, Mr. Blake, if you don't mind.
Your agent?
Yes, I have an agent and a publicist courtesy of the church. You see, when Mrs. Peterson saw Mary Magdalene's likeness in the boughs of the trees, the church decided my work was God's work, thus they have sponsored everything in which I've been involved. Both will need to be part of our negotiations, sir. To Joe, the money split with Mr. Blake would go directly to the church to repay them for his travels. If not for the tour, he'd have never made a book deal with a publishing company. This was God's way of providing for both himself and their church. Mr. Blake stared blankly at Joe for a moment, then cleared his throat loudly before turning on his heels and entering his office. This was not what Mr. Blake expected. He thought Joe would be a pushover, but he had underestimated him. He darkened his office door and said in a calm voice to Joe before Joe returned to his work,
"Perhaps you misheard me, Joe. I meant to say 25% of the net profits."
Joe nodded. "Thank you, sir. My agent will be in touch with you shortly to discuss profit sharing." As Joe exited the undertaker's office, he noticed there were several people coming out from the backside of the building where his greenhouse was built, carrying shopping bags with Mr. Blake's funeral home company logo upon them. As he turned the corner to see what was there, he was saddened to see a gift shop had replaced his greenhouse. He entered the makeshift shop to review the items for sale. Along with the t-shirts he'd seen on the campers in his front yard, there were postcards, keychains, framed prints of Mary Magdalene, fridge magnets, baseball caps, and pens. There was also a guest book open for visitors to sign. Joe spent a moment reading the notes from visitors. Hundreds of names and messages filled the thick brown leather-bound guest book, but this should not have been a surprise to Joe. In fact, nothing would surprise him anymore. To his left were piles of his gardening supplies stacked precariously without any level of respect. Joe fought his anger as he exited the gift shop. The lack of respect for his supplies was astonishing. Paying no further attention to the gift shop or to the endless visitors to the cemetery, Joe went about his business of repairing his gardens. He would have to save his hellos to his residents for when Mr. Blake closed the gates to the cemetery at 6 p.m. It would be the only time Joe would have the privacy to conduct his daily routine. The fall was unseasonably warm, but when winter arrived, it came in like a lion. Joe was prepared for winter this time. He used some of his substantial earnings to buy himself an industrial-sized snowblower and a road grader to attach to the front of his pickup truck. Now the town didn't have to suffer being snowed in like it had been last year while they waited for the machines from other towns to grace them with their presence. Joe was sure to take out his equipment every day to clear driveways for the sick and elderly, then continued to clear drivable paths to emergency services and the grocery store. No resident left behind, dead or alive, was Joe's motto. He even went as far as clearing paths beneath the tree arches in the cemetery so he and other visitors could safely navigate through. In fact, Joe rarely missed a day of visiting his residence regardless of the weather. This would be the first time in years that the residents of the town could congregate at the church for Christmas Mass and celebrate the New Year at the town hall, regardless of how much snow fell. During the New Year's party, the mayor of Garden of Eden presented Joe with a key to the town and a plaque of recognition for his community services to hang on his wall. Even with all the attention and his newfound wealth, Joe kept a level head. Over the following years, the visitors to the Garden of Eden Cemetery became more manageable. The fascination was reduced to seasonal visitors, and that was fine with Joe. Mr. Blake went back to his predominantly quiet existence as the funeral home director, and both Joe and Mr. Blake kept to themselves unless there was something urgent to discuss. 5 years later, Mr. Blake and his wife Joan decided to retire and move to Florida. He approached Joe with an offer.
Joe, me and the missus are wondering if you'd be interested to buy my funeral home business. We're moving to Florida in the spring.
Mr. Blake held his breath for a minute, wondering if Joe had any interest in taking over. He was the perfect person to approach since Joe had such a vested interest in the dead. Congratulations, Mr. Blake. I'm sure Mrs. Blake is excited to retire to somewhere sunny and warm. How much are you asking for the business?
Let me show you my sales revenue for the past year, and we can try to come to a mutual agreement of its value,
he suggested as he waved his hand toward his office to get Joe to follow him. They sat down together and hammered out a number that made them both happy. Since Joe's story had published finally and it had become a number one bestseller, a deal had been struck through Joe's agent for the movie rights, bringing in another influx of cash. To Joe, this was a sign from God to spend that windfall on purchasing the funeral home business from Mr. Blake. But instead of becoming the funeral director, Joe decided to hire someone else to do that work. Joe's only interest was in the cemetery property and caring for his residents. By the time Joe was nearing retirement for himself, he had spent 20 years as the bone gardener. He often chuckled when someone referred to him this way, but it was a nickname that stuck for the remainder of his career as a caretaker and owner of the Eden Funeral Home. On the 12th of July the following year, Joe became quite ill with the flu. Many of the locals were sick as well, but it seemed like a short-lived flu that passed within a few days or so for most folks. Joe was particularly hard hit. The night sweats, high fever, tossing and turning, pounding head, and constantly running nose took its toll on him. Within a week after Joe acquired the flu, his illness made him lightheaded, and this became the cause of his demise. Joe had put the kettle on to make a pot of tea when he remembered he'd left his cold and flu medication upstairs in his bedroom. He mumbled to himself about how crappy he felt as he trudged his way back upstairs to collect the pills from his side table. While trying to descend his staircase to return to his kitchen, a sudden spell of dizziness resulted in him losing his balance, thereby tumbling down the staircase and breaking his neck in the fall. His body lay crumpled against the base of the wall at the bottom of the staircase, while the whistle of the boiled water in the kettle sang out for nobody to hear. He was found the next morning by Catherine's daughter, who stopped in to provide Joe with a fresh batch of her homemade leek soup. The town mourned Joe's passing en masse. Their little church overflowed with throngs of people standing in long lineups, coming to pay their last respects. The big news agencies reported his death in the same manner they reported movie and rock stars passing. Nobody could forget the man called the Bone Gardener from Garden of Eden. Joe's associate, who ran the funeral home on his behalf, bought the most expensive casket he could find for Joe to be displayed and buried. The casket's exterior was solid maple, lacquered in a rich auburn tone. The silver handles glistened and the light splayed through the window of the church, and the pure white silk lining looked like a bed made of angel's wings. It took 2 full days before the last of the mourners had come to say goodbye. Father MacDonald came out of retirement to conduct the service for Joe. 6 pallbearers carried Joe's beautiful casket from the church to the spotless new hearse that Joe had recently purchased for his business. The irony of Joe being the first customer to use it was not lost on the congregation. His friends and admirers covered the hearse in bouquets of colorful flowers in honor of Joe's unforgettable gardens in the cemetery. Joe had reserved a plot for himself many years before beneath a twisted weeping birch he'd planted 20 years earlier. Next to the tree was a water feature Joe had installed, around which a kaleidoscope of annual flowers bloomed hardily. You could view Joe's final resting place at the end of the Bone Arches tunnel of the main cemetery grounds. The trees and his cemetery residents knew Joe was joining them in perpetuity. As Joe's casket was carried to his final resting place through the archway of the bone trees, each tree creaked loudly, then exploded into a cloud of fine dust, like fireworks, saluting him, one by one, disintegrating as if they never existed. Joe was now and forever a resident. Father MacDonald carefully swept the remnants of the bone tree dust from the sleeves of his suit while he choked back his emotions. He drew a heavy sigh as he watched the last of the daylight fade in the eyes of the mourners. They began their slow dissipation from Joe's gravesite, silent, save for those who could not stay their tears and wails of sorrow. When Joe began his duty as the Garden of Eden cemetery caretaker, nobody noticed him there. Nobody cared that once the gravesite services were over and everyone attending had paid their due respects, that Joe would fill the fresh rectangular cavity where their beloved now lay with the displaced earth and tend to this spot day after day. Joe was the quiet gardener, the attentive, silent partner of every resident at the cemetery, the caretaker of lost souls. Joe's headstone simply read, "Here lies Joe Arthur White, the Bone Gardener." The end. Thank you for listening. The Bone Gardener is a production of Sandra A. Sigfusson. All rights reserved. Copyright 2025. For information on other novels by this author, please visit her website at sandrasigfusson.com. On Facebook, search for @SandraSigfusson. On Instagram, search for @SigFusson. Your reviews are always welcome.